Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. The deaths of five schoolchildren in Malaysia had provoked an extinguished debate about education and what it means to be Malay. The children had run away from their boarding school in Kelantan State and died of starvation in the jungle. They were afraid of harsh punishments from their teachers. Two girls survived eating grass and wild fruit, but were found emasculated and close to death 47 days later. The children came from the Orangasi community, one of the poorest and most marginalized in the country. Lucy Ash traveled to the remote region where the children came from and talks to their bereaved parents. Most families are now refusing to send their children to school, and campaigners accuse the government of not doing enough to protect the rights of that community.
Have you got a favourite colour? Well, you got light brown, is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that are going to make some nice gold earrings. Very messy hair, because I don't like brushing my hair.
I'm doing a self-portrait lying on the floor of a bamboo hut, drawing with crayons and felt tips, surrounded by a group of small children. They're telling me all about the school they used to go to and about one of their teachers.
Not good.
Why not good?
They didn't like him because he liked to punish them even if they didn't do anything wrong, like making them stand outside in the sun holding their desks on their head.
Was it heavy?
Dia berat ke meja tu?
Berat.
Heavy.
Yeah. Very heavy. Yeah. Can you show me?
That's how he told them to do it.
What, to bend their knees as well?
If you did it like he said, then that would be okay. But if you dropped the table or if you fell, then he would ask you to do it for a longer time.
Noreen, she started off with her back to me. She's now kind of looking at me, but she's not saying very much. She doesn't want to speak. And you can understand why, can't you?
Pretty harsh treatment for primary school pupils by most standards. For 10-year-old Noreen and her classmates in their remote boarding school in northern Malaysia, the discipline was too much to bear. They ran away from school and spent weeks lost in the jungle. The children are Orang Asli, which in Malay means original people, and they're the earliest known inhabitants of the Malaysian Peninsula. What happened to these vulnerable youngsters from an already vulnerable community has raised some uncomfortable questions in this prosperous, rapidly modernising Southeast Asian nation. Night has fallen, and in a long bamboo hut raised off the ground by stilts, people are preparing for a sewang, a traditional ceremony to invoke the spirits that they believe inhabit the forests. It's partly an attempt to heal the trauma suffered by Noreen and others in her community.
The whole place is decorated with big banana leaves and ferns and fragrant flowers, and there are leaves in a bowl in the middle of the room.
All of these leaves that we see hanging up here are from the jungle. So the idea is for the spirits to feel comfortable when they come down here.
So it's their normal habitat?
Yes, yes.
With Alan, our guide and translator, we've come on a long journey from Kuala Lumpur. First on the highway, and then on muddy, bone-jarring logging roads. This village, Kampung Panat, is deep inside the state of Kelantan near the Thai border. All around the room, women sit cross-legged in front of hollow bamboo tubes. There are 18 different Orang Asli tribes. These people belong to the Temiar, who live in the mountainous interior and who follow a shamanistic religion closely linked to the land which sustains them. A young man in a leafy headdress and a loincloth leads people in a rhythmic stomp around the room. Some begin to sway as if in a trance. A baby lying on a blanket next to me watches wide-eyed and spellbound. Exactly what happened in the rainforest is still something of a mystery. In this edition of Assignment, I look at the treatment of Malaysia's indigenous people through the disturbing tale of these young runaways. And I ask, what does it say about Malaysian society as a whole? Mida is washing at the village standpipe. She's a large woman dressed in yellow with strikingly sad eyes. Recently widowed, she's the mother of two of the children who fled the school, Noreen and her youngest child, Haikal. The school is located at a settlement called Postahoy, a two-hour drive or a day's walk away. So pupils from villages around here have to board in a hostel on the grounds. Mida says Haikal was due to start school last year when he turned 7.
He was very attached to her. She was worried that something might happen to him because he was so small. Then this year she sent him to school and this terrible thing happened. He said, well, we didn't think much of the school or the hostel. The security at the hostel was really not good at all. The fences were always broken.
In a house opposite, I meet Ayel, a wiry man with shoulder-length hair wearing a traditional raffia headdress. He also had misgivings about sending his daughter, Ika, aged 9.
He said, well, we didn't have any choice. I mean, we're deep in the jungles and that's the closest school to where we are, where we live.
How important is it for you to send your children to school?
He thinks it's very important because that's the future for them, so that they can get jobs, so that their lives will be better in the future.
The timeline of this story is hard to uncover because the only real witnesses are two traumatized young girls. They said the 7 children ran away on the morning of August 23rd because they were scared of punishment. The day before, a group of older pupils and Noreen had been beaten for swimming in the river. They were 11-year-old Miksudia Aluj, Ika Ayel, aged 9, Linda Rosli and Sasa Sobri, both aged 8, Juvina David, aged 7, and Mida's kids Noreen Jacob and her little brother Haikal. Mida first heard the news that evening from a neighbour who'd been shopping in town.
Initially, she didn't worry too much. She thought they would come back or they would be found. The next afternoon, still no news, and she started getting really worried, crying and crying, wondering what may have happened, were they kidnapped or, you know, all sorts of things. We didn't know what to think. We couldn't imagine what had happened, why it had happened. We didn't have any indication where the kids had been, you know, any tracks of them, no signs at all.
Remarkably, once the authorities got involved, Ika's dad, Ayel, and the other village men were told they weren't allowed to join the search and rescue operation. Instead, the police came to the village late at night to search a number of homes, apparently suspecting the parents of hiding their offspring. Then, on September the 2nd, 11 days after the children disappeared, Mida and the other families got a letter saying the pupils would be expelled unless they immediately returned to the classroom.
Police and all of these other people, they came up to this village and they looked all around this house and they went to look in the farm, accusing them of hiding these kids as if they were criminals. That was the way they were treated. She said she thinks that the only time that they really realized that the Asli were not hiding the kids was when they found the body of Linda.
This is where the first body was found.
We're just looking down at a river.
Yeah, we're looking down Sungai Prias River.
I'm with Siti Kasim, a lawyer from Kuala Lumpur, representing the families. She's a somewhat incongruous figure with her bleached blonde hair, sparkly nail varnish and round mirror shades. But Siti's made many trips up here and she knows her way around. We're in one of those rare spots in the rainforest where you can get a mobile phone signal. That's why, on October the 7th, a lorry driver pulled up here.
He stopped his lorry and he was calling someone and he was walking up and down here. Then he saw something bobbing up and down.
In the water?
In the water. The body got stuck in between the branch with the head down and only the upper body, you can see the legs and from the waist up. So he wasn't sure. He thought it was like a doll or something, you know, because the body's already white. But he looked closer and he saw it's a child's body. Then he went back to Tohoi and called the police. So that is so painful. I when I heard that, I feel my heart, even telling it now, I feel so upset. Can you imagine how they died?
How they died can only be pieced together from the distressing testimony of Noreen and Mick Sudhir, who were found 2 days later on October the 9th. The children ate leaves but couldn't find much else. The only fruit they could reach proved hard and indigestible. According to Noreen, her little brother Haikal was the first to die. Mida, their mother, picks up the story.
He was thirsty and he was drinking from the river. Then he fell into the river and the other kids were also really weak and they couldn't help him. And he just floated away, so likely he drowned.
Others suffered serious injuries. 7-year-old Juvina sustained a broken leg.
Juvina was saying, "I'm really hungry, I want something to eat." And Noreen said, "We've got nothing." And then the next morning, Juvina died. And Noreen took her to one side and put leaves on her. And then for the next 2 days, she said she watched what happens to her body. And Mida said, "Even us adults don't experience these things." She saw flies in her eyes and her mouth and her ears. And then after that, she saw maggots coming out of the body and the hair falling out.
Sounds really terrible.
Yes, Noreen saw so many terrible things. She saw so many of her friends die one by one and her brother.
Mida says her daughter and Mick Sudhir were skeletal and close to death themselves when they were finally discovered 47 days after they left the school.
They were too weak. They couldn't stand up. They couldn't walk about. When the police finally found them and the army finally found them, they cried when they saw that these kids had actually made a shelter for themselves.
The policemen's tears are understandable. They'd been searching a massive area using sniffer dogs and helicopters. But the children were actually on a riverbank just 2 kilometres from the school. So why did it take so long to find them? What's so heartbreaking is that these deaths might have been avoided if only the authorities had listened to the parents instead of excluding them from the search. Colin Nicholas from a group called the Centre for Orang Asli Concerns believes the children were so terrified that even though they were hungry and injured, they still hid from their rescuers. The Senoi Pra unit of indigenous trackers is often used to look for people lost in the jungle, but not, he says, in this case.
Instead, they bring in the soldiers, the army, you know, people who are used to hunting down enemies and the smugglers, and who go into the forest with military fatigues, backpacks and machine guns. If you really put your mind in the mind of a child, you know, you see a bunch of guys coming you with guns looking for you, you think you say, "Hey, I'm here," no? No. They're running, obviously running away. In the end, the Senoi Pra was finally called in, Orang Asli trackers, and they were the ones who eventually found the kids, you know?
Noreen and Mick Sudhir were rushed to hospital in the nearest town of Gua Musang. The bodies of the other children, apart from Sasa, who has yet to be found, were taken to the mortuary.
These are pictures of Ika, a very pretty little girl. And there's a picture of her with her... Yeah, a picture of her with her younger brother. She's wearing a red flower in her hair and putting her hand on his shoulder very protectively.
Ayel says he and his wife Nora were shown Ika's remains in a cardboard box. She could only be identified by her necklace and bracelet.
The whole family still feels very, very sad. They can't stop thinking about her, especially because she was a very helpful little girl.
The lawyer, Siti Kasim, shows me a clip she filmed at the children's funeral. Rites are read over a line of small pink coffins decorated with flowers.
Oh, kami pun ada harapan juga lah dengan Kak Siti.
Ya, saya akan cuba bermati-matian untuk buat kes ni. Memang ini satu saya
tak. In the long bamboo hut which serves as a village hall, Siti's now talking to families about possible legal action against the school and the government for negligence. Are they hoping for some kind of financial compensation?
This is not the first time incidents of death happened in the Orang Asli schools. Children that have died before, no action taken. So this time, they have to go and do something about it, they say. So that is really their primary motivation. And the money is secondary. Number one is to teach the authorities that, you know, they cannot treat their children like this. Nita, Angelie, lagi seorang siapa?
Siti is trying to get a clear picture of events from the children who attended the school. Don't be afraid, tell me the truth, she says. Who went to swim in the river and who was beaten?
Besar mana? Besar ni? Ranting.
Jeruk.
With what? Huh? A stick? What kind of wood? Where did the stick come from? The children are shy and it's not easy extracting information from them. The Temiar are famously non-confrontational. And parents, I notice, rarely shout at children here, let alone smack them.
Cikgu! Nama apa tu, cikgu? Terima kasih.
Terima kasih. Some of these girls are going to show us where to go to meet the teachers.
Suka.
We've just come into the premises of the Posterhoy school. This is the school that the children ran away from. It's a Sunday afternoon in the Muslim state of Kelantan. School starts on a Sunday.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hi. My name's Lucy Ash. I'm from BBC Radio. Nice to meet you.
These teachers are not exactly delighted to see us. They ask us not to use their names and are initially reluctant to talk.
We are not allowed.
Under police investigation.
It's under police investigation. Right. Because we've heard that children were beaten at this school.
Oh, no.
Beaten
no.
with sticks.
No. Rumours.
Rumours?
The children were not beaten at all.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Because they told us that they were beaten many times. Something must have happened to make them want to leave.
They say they want to run out. They plan out to run.
They plan to run away?
Yeah, back to their village.
They want to go to their village. Because they haven't been there for so long, so they want to go.
So you think it was just because they felt homesick?
Homesick, yes.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're just playing around. They just want to play around.
This teacher's job isn't easy, as most pupils speak Temiar, not Malay, when they arrive, and many drop out early. So are there any special activities to encourage the kids to learn?
Every weekend, we do cleaning.
Cleaning?
Their own room, to make sure there is no rubbish, there is no thing that we don't want in their room. Leaves, rocks, something.
You don't want them to have leaves and rocks in their room?
Yeah, because after that, they just scattered around on the floor, and we don't want that in the hostel.
Maybe they're homesick for the forest. Maybe that's why they bring leaves and rocks in.
They just want to go and play with the rocks.
This teacher doesn't seem on the same page as his pupils. Like other officials I meet, he undervalues the Orang Asli's deep connection to the forests in which they've always lived. The Malaysian government is committed to fast-tracking prosperity. But for indigenous people, this headlong rush for growth is catastrophic. Teams of men with bulldozers and chainsaws and trucks laden with tree trunks are ripping away the Orang Asli's environment from underneath them. And it's disappearing day by day.
Is this man in the beige baseball hat, is he the foreman here?
Yeah, like foreman, yeah.
This rakyat, ini kontrak. Kita jaga kontrak. Ini
said on one day, they can cut down about 500 trees.
In one day, 500 trees?
Small, big. They're cutting everything.
This deforestation causes landslides and has turned the river the colour of milky tea. Last winter, Kampung Panad was completely cut off by floods for weeks. I'm with Dendi, the young man who led the Sewang ceremony.
If the company did destroy this forest, so Bunian or Putri Gunung, they angry.
The god that you worship will be angry.
Yeah.
And then what will happen?
Berlaku banjir lah.
No, he says it's not just the god, but this area also has lots of different spirits. and princesses of the hills. And you said, what will happen?
Akibat dia akan banjir.
So the consequence is flood.
That's why my people, they love forest much. Because forest, we can live forever. Forest like Giant, like Tesco, like supermarket.
The forest is like Tesco?
Yeah, like Tesco, like Giant, like supermarket.
Like Giant, like a big supermarket. Yeah. So it's not just food, it's also a pharmacy. Yeah. It's also where you find your medicine.
All thing.
Dendi helped to get the land mapped by GPS, and with his mobile phone, he collects evidence of the current destruction, which can be used in court.
Government say orang asli very stupid. They don't know anything. I not agree lah. All nation have intelligence. You know my people, they also very clever. But the government, they don't want give orang asli good education. Because if they think orang asli very clever, next time orang asli, they can take this land again.
In Kuala Lumpur, Deputy Education Minister P. Kamalanadan tells me the government is doing everything it can for the orang asli. He bemoans the high dropout rate, more than 40% in some areas. But he says it's often because parents would rather their children help them to pick beans in the jungle.
I try to tell them, look, you don't think about short term, think about long term. When you educate this child will grow better and they get a better job and their child will come back and take care of the family. And I give him examples.
But I want to know whether sending children of primary school age to boarding school is a good idea. Aren't they a bit young to be separated from their families?
We give them an option. We give an option to the parents to make that decision. We will not take the child away without the parents' consent. I think the issue that took place in Tohoi Primary School is still being investigated. We are still waiting for a final report from the police.
Is corporal punishment allowed in schools in Malaysia?
No, it's not allowed. If there is a complaint of that nature, all they need to do is come and lodge a complaint. We will surely take action if there's a complaint.
Well, I think he might be living in cloud cuckoo land if he doesn't know there have been many complaints of the orang asli against schools, interior schools.
The family's lawyer, Siti Kasim.
We can prove there are police reports made, you know. They have wrote letters of complaint, but nothing happened. In fact, there was one incident where four girls being slapped very hard by a teacher because they refused to recite a prayer in Arabic, Islamic prayers before you eat, because they are not Muslim.
In March, Kelantan's State Assembly voted in favour of Sharia law, or hudud as it's known here. At present, it's unlikely that the federal government would allow punishments like amputations and stoning. But many orang asli now find themselves in the least tolerant corner of Malaysia. Ika's older sister, Azmida, used to go to the school in Pos Tohoi and recalls how she was treated there.
Azmida said that yes, definitely there's discrimination against orang aslis here. They call them smelly, wearing savage clothes.
Dia kuat dengan agama Islam lah.
Her father says he thinks it's because they see themselves, Kelantan, as the heartland of Islam in Malaysia, and he thinks that's got something to do with it.
Cikgu, dia orang suruh kita orang masuk Islam.
When she was at school, Azmida was at school, there was a lot of pressure for them to become Muslims.
What kinds of things did they say to you?
Dia orang cakap macam ni lah.
If you join this religion, then you won't eat pig anymore and you'll be part of a clean religion.
Colin Nicholas from the Orang Asli Advocacy Group says indigenous people are being increasingly sucked into a Malay-centric nation-state.
The objective of the government is to bring the orang asli into the mainstream of society. They used the word integration, but at one time it was assimilation. That means make them Malays, no? So if you want to do that, the best and fastest way is through education. You pluck out young children, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds from the village, put them in a school hostel for, you know, three months at a time without seeing their parents, give them a new education, give them a new culture, give them a new language, and sometimes a new religion. And in one generation, you have people who are no longer orang asli.
Janita Enji, who is orang asli herself and first trained as a midwife, set up a community school in the neighbouring state of Pahang.
Don't say that I'm your teacher, so you have to follow whatever I say. That's not teaching, that's a controlling. You control them. They are not animal. Malaysian governments have to look deeply into Orang Asli education. We hope there's no others Orang Asli children who runs away just because of the treatment of the schools, you know.
Back in Kampung Panat, Mida tells me no way are the village children going back to classes in Pos Tohoi.
We sent our kids to school and five lives were lost. I would like the kids to have an education, but if they don't build the schools in the villages, it doesn't matter, because unless the government takes away our land, we can still survive in this jungle. I'm angry with the Orang Asli department. I'm angry with the government. I'm angry with the teachers. She said the last government elections, they came and they promised all sorts of things. They always promise all sorts of things, schools and roads, but in fact they don't do anything. So she said the next elections, this whole village is not going to vote.
Mida senses that the Orang Asli are valued as political or religious pawns, little else. 77% still live beneath the poverty line, but the government's failure to improve their lives is often blamed on the Orang Asli themselves for supposedly rejecting development. When I ask the deputy minister about a new school for these villagers, he's non-committal. The Orang Asli make up less than 1% of the population, and there are many competing claims on resources. In the 70s, a decade after independence from Britain, the government tried to diffuse ethnic tensions by granting special rights to the so-called Bumiputra, or Sons of the Soil. The Orang Asli, who arrived on this peninsula thousands of years before ethnic Malays, belong to this category. But for many, it doesn't feel that way. They say the state ignores their rights, takes their land, and has little interest in helping them to preserve their identity. They may be the truly original people, but they say they're also the most overlooked and oppressed.
And that's all we have time for in this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. PCJmedia@gmail.com. Also, let us know where you heard the program, if it was through one of our partner stations on medium wave, shortwave, or FM, or through the World Radio Network, or even online. Anyway, that's it. That's all we have time for. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.